Blog Talk Radio.
Version of Sultry Stories. I'm your host, Michael O'Sengen, teacher of Honeycomb, and as always, it's good to have you here. Tonight, a little science fiction. Part one of a continuing series entitled The Heroes of Harmony Corners, written by yours truly. Let's see what comes about here. Quote, "Now you know what the old heads believe, don't you? All bad things come in threes." Said by activist and freedom fighter Roscoe Chance Beckford, 1973-2056. The year is 2056, and it's October 14th. A shared Cadillac slowly makes its way through the gravelly dirt road leading to the wrought iron gates of There Are Angels Cemetery, located in Harmony Corners Village, New York, just off Interstate Highway 87 at the edge of town. The five cars that follow roll behind, sunlight glancing off the front windows so intensely that they take on the sparkle of semi-precious stones in the rays of Indian summer. Through the gates, and a quarter mile or so within, the procession stops, and the limousine driver opens the passenger side rear door. Two black women, both in their early 30s, alight from the car. From the other vehicles, 11 men and women, all similar in age, give and take a year or two, emerge and walk with the two women toward the top of a rise a few feet away where a circle of lawn chairs awaits them. Standing atop the rise, the group formed a circle, each one glancing at the other before nodding and bowing their heads in a moment of silent prayer. A few seconds later, the two sisters in unison as they raise their heads. They say, "Them that know, don't say." The 11 others replied in kind, "And them that say, don't know." The taller, redder, and thicker of the sisters spoke first. "Please, everyone sit down. My name is Nicole Daniels Beckford, and I am here for my father." From her purse, Nicole pulled out a Johnny Quest 25 laser pistol, and with surgeon-like precision, blasted a 1-foot-by-1-foot hole into the ground, forming into a smoldering perfect square. It was Roscoe Beckford who was accused of initiating the first of the clone meat riots in February of 2017, in spite of almost dying at the hands of police. He spoke to the masses, warning everyone that would listen. The public had the right to know. They had until April 2nd of that year to coalesce and question the actions of the government. A lit, slightly darker woman then piped up, "My name is Nia Danielle Beckford. Prior to that first incident, my father traveled to Nairobi at the behest of organic food interests and found incontrovertible proof of the dangers of synthetic biology for the world's food supply at the World Social Forum. We know now his findings were crucial in spurring then-Michigan Congresswoman Mira Stachewski to introduce into the House of Representatives bills H.R. 511268, the Genetically Engineered Food Safety Act, and H.R. 511269, the Genetically Engineered Right to Know Act, in an attempt to hold someone accountable. Nicole, the older of the two Beckford women, put her arm around her sister as she was fighting back tears, gesturing to the next in the circle, a reddish-brown young man with high cheekbones, wearing a distinctive University of Miami pin on his sports jacket. My name is Anthony Swanson, and my godfather, Sir Norris Rollins, was a colleague and friend of your father. My godfather was very influential down home in the Virgin Islands, and he asked Mr. Beckford to speak about what he knew because there was a lot of talk about the fish tasting funny, and he didn't know who to turn on this. Through their joint efforts, they discovered the U.S. Food and Drug Administration had informally agreed to begin regulation of transgenic fish without any public forum or proof of food safety. It was some time after they made this information public in October 2018. Sometime thereafter, evidence was uncovered. An abandoned factory in Charlotte-Amalie was discovered to be a testing facility for a drug company, and they had been working on the quiet for over a decade. Shortly after this, my godfather was persona non grata everywhere in the islands. It almost broke him, but your father's friendship and faith kept him going, even after people who were his supposed friends turned their backs on him. If I had come here just to say this to you, I would be eternally grateful. But it seems quite apparent there is a lot more going on here. The headline of today's edition of the Pure News would make many an onlooker scratch their heads. In block lettering, it says, "Remember, we used to resolve it among ourselves." In this time, the Pure News, TPN, used to be what some used to call an alternative newspaper. And yes, they still print newspapers now. Now, you won't see headlines like "Secretary of State spotted sniffing soiled Speedos" for the lines at the supermarket count. But TPN does its best to speak truth to power in the most obtuse of manners. Kind of like when the old transnational tattler printed photos of phony Lee Harvey Oswalds in 1963 in their papers while the rest of electric and print media quietly walked away from the murder scene. An item from a 1999 issue of TPN produced one of those items that seemed to slip below the radar from time to time, as Pure News is wont to do. In 1999, researchers at the University of Saskatchewan altered the gene pattern of certain edible plants in order to make their ripened versions more adaptable for colder climes, giving rise to the creation of genetically engineered GE foods. What's truly freaky about stuff like this is it usually appears as a flat statement, never with a follow-up. But a few years later, another bit of related information ominously popped up. In 2007, the United States Food and Drug Administration declared meat and milk from cloned animals safe for human consumption without additional necessary distinguishable labeling. The final straw came in 2011 as scientists in Japan revealed at a press conference that they had successfully created a meat product from fecal matter. The purpose behind creating these shit steaks was to mass produce cheap protein to sell in poor and developing countries. Never mind what possessed these motherfuckers to do this. Now that the mystery behind mystery meat has been solved, anyone too poor or hungry or naive to read the label did so at their own peril. Any plans to eliminate printed news and go to full net infusion was squashed given the chaos created by the hacker wars of 2021, when we almost blew each other the fuck up. The problem was traced to a, quote, minor malfunction somewhere near within the Department of Homeland Security, but statements to the general public implied otherwise. Harmony Corners Village, New York, is a Tony area sitting about 25 miles north of Saratoga Springs. Back in the day, lots of cats that used to play the final weekend of the Alizé Jazz and PM Post-Millennium Funk Festival would slide over to do private gigs at the estates of the town's elite before heading up to Quebec for Montreal's Jazz Festival. Of course, if you weren't a player or just connected like that, you would never know about it. It just wasn't the sort of thing that got out, not even by word of mouth. Because in spite of the sprawling mansions and ultra-posh setting, Harmony Corners Village was not the most harmonious of locales if you didn't live there. Planned communities like this seem so cookie-cutter, even for high price spreads. But it is always the most unassuming of places, which seem to sow the seeds of evil in the most malicious of manners. January 24th, 2017. The lunch hour rush had hit Big Mama's just off 126th Street and Lenox Avenue in Harlem. Chance Beckford stuck his head out to see if his friend had arrived. A booming baritone greeted him. Chance, it's good to see you, bro, bellowed Marcus Simpson. Even close up, it was hard for his buddy to whisper. Samson, a stocky, broad-shouldered cat, was a walking residence box and a damn good musician. So what's up, music man? Still spanking that bass?
Ain't nobody doubt it, my man. But I think I have something you've been looking for. Come on in the back to have Big Mama hook us up.
A couple of universal nods, some of the lunchtime locals, and Beckford and Sampson slipped by the tables into the kitchen area and through a narrow walkway toward a formal dining room. The two men were sitting.
This is Jim Hannaford and Bert Freeman. They are from the Center for Food Safety in Washington, D.C., said Sampson. You know my niece? She's studying veterinary medicine. Well, she volunteers for this group, and she told them about what you're trying to do.
I'm a policy analyst at the center, offered Hannaford, who spoke in a pleasant twang as he extended his hand. I may be able to answer some of your questions regarding cloning of animals. Mr. Freeman would be better suited to speak on the genetic engineering of plants. After acknowledging Freeman, Chance buckled. Seems strange conversation over a rack of ribs, fellas, but I've seen strangers since my eyes have been open to this. Freeman interjected. Well, one thing I know you can tell people is to do what Big Mama's doing here at her establishment. From what she told me, she shops for and gets natural and organic whenever possible. It's the farmer's market with a vengeance. If there's been any light to the issue of cloning in GE Foods, it's that smaller farms have been able to specialize, grow organic, and get more for their crops. Do you know what a bushel of corn normally goes for? Anywhere from $2 to $3 for a bushel. That's 50 pounds of corn. That's a major reason why the industry is so heavily subsidized. Chance shook his head. Damn, you're the city kid. I had no idea. So since you brought this up, why did this whole farming thing swing to GE Food? Technology would be the first thought, but as it goes, genetic engineering is primitive. Years ago, chemical companies like Devereaux and Montmartre started buying seed crops. Montmartre made this very powerful weed killer called Surrender, which not only killed the weeds, but the crops too. So GE was used to develop seeds that could withstand the weed killer. And anyone that didn't buy, those seeds couldn't use the herbicide. Because of the tinkering, that GE weakened the weed killer as the weeds regained their level of resistance. Now, you're talking natural adaptation like Darwin's finches. Exactly like that. Ultimately, over 80% of GE food became herbicide tolerant, and with the continuous purchases of seed crops, Mount Montana put themselves in a favorable position.
Shit, blurted Sampson. The farmers are fucked. You either buy the designer seeds or buy the chemicals to properly kill the weeds and pass that chance.
They get paid either end. Sighing, Chance returned to Hannaford. I hope the news is a little better on the meat side. Well, I can tell you that the animals are subjected to some of the most brutal technology around. Animal cloning has been going on for a while, but the results are questionable. After the clones are produced, 94% live long enough to produce again.
But what about Dolly the sheep? Didn't she live like 6 years?
Sampson, yes, she did. The problem is, under normal circumstances, Dolly should have lived to be at least 12. And in her last months, Dolly was severely arthritic. Chance could tell his old friend Sampson had that get the fuck out of here look on his face as he gasped.
So if Dolly's ass had turned into lamb chops and mutton, we wouldn't have known whoever ate her would have been eating a sick and diseased animal.
Yep, deadpan Hanford. There's definitely a stomach-turning factor to that.
Chance took a sip of beer, smacked his lips. What company is out in front of this cloning stuff?
Right now, there are two companies doing animal cloning. One is called Zygora, based in Pennsylvania. They're a subsidiary of a biotechnology firm called Vantage Cell Technology. The other one is a Texas company called Voyagene. There was a previous company that failed last year called Genetic Cravings and Grown that specialized in cloning pets. But the aforementioned two companies clone livestock.
Makes me think about that thing Pops used to say about how a copy of a copy loses its integrity, said Chance.
You only use a tea bag for so many times. Analogies aside, you're correct. A couple years ago, the Chinese did several cloning experiments with carp. After several cloning efforts, which produced 500 clones, it was found that 7% of the clones had the wrong number of vertebrae.
Is that because of DNA, queried Chance?
Not just DNA, mitochondrial DNA. The mitochondria control structure and development, and some of the effects on cattle. Can be huge calves at birth, damaging the birth canal beyond repair. Cloned animals seem to be born sicker and stay sicker longer than natural-born ones. But it is done because cloning is the way we will get GE in animals.
As Hannaford spoke, everybody sat in silence for a few seconds. So, who's down for the pitch cobbler?
Said Sampson, smiling.
October 14th, 2056.
The others assembled also spoke of their connection to Beckford. Like a patchwork quilt, each piece of the puzzle was sewn together. Through the mouths of Serena Williams, an ex-tennis coach from Florida A&M University, Tamika Hundley, a medical coder, Adam Drayton, a boxer and rising star in the middleweight division, Kwame Gray, a staff writer at TPN, Jeanette Hatchett, a sous chef, Donnell Butch Harrison, a subway conductor, Walter Gator Green, an environmental officer, Gail Barbara Givens, press secretary for a city agency, Malcolm Brown, a social worker, and Celeste Allison, a bus driver. As Drayton listened, his eyes began to tear up, his mind drifting to a press conference 3 weeks ago. The experts had it wrong. Drayton had made his point by planting Jimmy the Punk Pendleton like a turnip in the sixth round at the left-right combination his trainer, Horacio Knocko Jones, nicknamed the Atom Bomb. As the bomb exploded on Pendleton's gut and chin, a front row laden with boxing intelligentsia clamoring for a unification bout with Pitbull Polnoff, were now wondering whether serving white or red wine went better with Crow. Four people walked into the green room to a smattering of applause that night. Drayton was accompanied by Jones, a young black child of about 10 years, holding what looked like a plastic juice bottle, and the promoter, Ira Madoff. Madoff's wry smile seemed to indicate he had played both ends against the middle, so he was bound to profit no matter who had won the fight. Placards at the table were hastily made for Drayton and Jones. As the group sat down, there was a huge rattling noise coming in from the juice bottle before Drayton plunked it on the table. A tall, bespectacled man entered soon after, walking straight to the podium and microphone. Members of the press, I'm Dave Bernstein, and as Public Relations Director here, I welcome you once again to Madison World Garden, still the universe's most famous arena. At this time, I want to present Mr. Ira Madoff, who wants to say a few words before questions. A slight head gesture, and Madoff rose from his spot at the table and headed toward Bernstein. On behalf of the Garden staff and Ponzi Productions, we saw an exciting fight with an even more exciting finish, as it seems. A new contender has been added to the mix of the always tough middleweight division. Congratulations to Mr. Adam Bomb Drake, shouted Madoff to another smattering of applause. Man with the specs again came to the podium. We will now open the floor for questions, said Bernstein. Before anyone could say anything about the fight, a voice from the back blurted out, "Hey, Drake, what's with the bottle? What are you saving up for?" to a room full of laughter. Drayton spoke with a calm but firm demeanor. This jar represents a combination of desperation and perspiration, fueled by the inspiration of a great man. A Pure News article entitled "The Ignorance Jar, Part 1" by Roscoe Bedford is being read. Produced by the Pure News, September 19, 1999. Dateline, Vancouver, Canada. Over the last 2 years and change that I've spent here contributing to our website, I've been privy to some rather unusual insights by people who responded to columns written by myself as well as some of my colleagues. This particular line of thought began a few years ago with an empty juice bottle. 363 days ago, that bottle was headed for the trash bin until a choice comment changed my mind. As I stooped down to pick up something to throw in the garbage, a white woman stopped short and gasped as if in mortal danger. When she finally came to her senses and saw I would do her no harm, she said, "I thought you were a cat," before scurrying off with a flushed face. Now, I don't meow, chase mice, I have a tail. It's broad daylight, and the woman's right in front of my face. I gotta wonder about the sincerity of the statement, you know? Unless her surname is Magoo, that's a rather stupid thing to say. When I walked back inside, I hadn't realized that I'd taken the bottle with me. The incident was my wake-up call for the day. While I consider myself to be a well-adjusted human being, that BS doesn't mean you must wonder sometimes, when the hell will this BS stop? If I had a nickel for every time shoved and showed their ignorance about black folks in front of my face, I'd be a millionaire. Well, there you go. Not that I was hit with a resounding blow of inspiration, but it became clear to me that this was one way to make chicken salad out of chicken lips. I took the jar, I put in 5 pennies, and promised myself every time I heard nonsense coming out of someone's mouth, I'd throw 5 cents in each time. Thinking about earlier columns I had written about intra-ethnic bias, I threw in a case dime and promised a dime would go in every time someone black said something stupid about black people, the logic being twice as much for being twice as stupid. You should know better by now. Throughout the year, as diligent as I attempted to be, the above amount is not as much as it could have been. I missed a lot of stuff, and the inhabitants of the lower mainland have only themselves to thank or blame for their lack of understanding of how words can hurt. Here are some of the more idiotic statements that your neighbors have chosen to share with you. overheard courtesy of the Hotel Vancouver. Somewhat inebriated white male to the young African man in the euro.
Say, boys, can I borrow a couple of inches? I got a hot order of Punjabi Poontang waiting outside.
Or this one, from a member of the local media to a colleague.
She obviously misunderstood. The invitation said black tie optional, not black guy optional.
Another bouquet from your local media. Jealous white male that can't wear bright colors. What's the hydro bill for that shirt? School days. If a black man didn't invent the streetlight, it was only to avoid learning to read stop signs. Or this beauty. Wanted. Workers for the night shift at the rib shack. Must be speaking ebonics.
Oh, Canada. From the border crossing, referring to my dreadlocks. Do you have any weapons or drugs hidden in there?
Or how about, you don't look like a journalist. When asked what a journalist looked like, the border guard said, you're too ethnic.
Also, from the board,
you know black men, they make great lovers, but lousy fathers and husbands. Although I have heard that phrase a few times, the first time I heard it last year was from a woman who works for Canada's Department of Immigration, who was just involved in a threesome a week ago, up to her tonsils in big black cock. How do I know this? One of the principals in this spit and swallow diatribe confirmed the identity between mouthfuls of cow foot soup at Ziggy's. None of my business for sure, but truly high up on the ear pollution scale.
Ball talk. Out the mouths of babes. I know I got a nigger butt, and the black guys just love it. Yo, man, let's take it. The security guys following the Somalis, they feel better than we do.
You can't be the ace of hearts when you look like the ace of spades. The only real reason you got knocked up was to try to hold on to your man, just like all them black hoochies in the States.
Love, or is that lust,
is a very stupid thing. Well, I only date black guys. I don't know why, though. They're all players, and they dog you out.
Careful, Mike. That spade pussy is powerful stuff. It'll put a voodoo spell on you.
White male, eyeing black female.
Looks like she had puberty at 8 years old.
This one I had to walk away from. Is your penis as long as your dreads? And last but far from least, this sick attempt at humor. I'd rather you snatch my handbag. So after a year's time, I counted the loot. Came to $65.95. But the amazing thing was that $46.60 of it was in dimes. Each case dime, all 466 of them, representing black-on-black stupidity. So 466 times, an average of over once a day, someone black made a point of saying something disparaging about another black person within earshot. Many in our community talk big talk about helping. Now let's see some action. How many will match or better this bottle full of loose change? I have donated this loot to a local shelter courtesy of TPN, and I have now started my ignorance draw for 2000. It would be nice to say my contribution next year would be considerably smaller, but just consider, if all of you out there started your own ignorance draws, think of the possibilities. Without any major effort, over $65 in nickels, dimes, and pennies was stashed in a year. Imagine that times 50,000 predominantly black households throughout the lower mainland. While you do the math, remember that words have power, and so do actions. More than anything, the breakdown of the change means one thing. Remember to clean your own house before you speak on how dirty someone else's is. So, before the gods of Coinstar receive their offering, I'll be back to break it down. The saddest thing about this jar is that this damn jar filled up really quick. Drink continued. The change in the bottle represents the first donation from my Ignorance Jar Foundation
And this money came from all of you. It's 5 cents was thrown in for each time you guys said something stupid about me or doubted my ability. And if the cameras can zoom in and catch this, you can make out that the jar is about half full. Once it's at capacity, I will count the cash and point out there's some of this hard-earned dough went in terms of remarks, and I will match the donation times 1,000. So on behalf of myself, my nephew Carlton here, and all of you, I want to thank you for helping getting this thing off the ground. For all the success Drayton had accomplished through his grit and determination, Serena Williams had succeeded in a different way. Drayton is an up-and-coming star in the manner of Madison Keys, Sloane Stephens, and her surname sisters, Venus and Serena. Serena, at 5'11 and 170 curvy pounds, had the elegance of Venus and the power of Serena. Everything pointed to a bright future in the world of tennis until a backhand lunge changed her life. A passing shot in which she slid into it, everything under control, but came out with a resounding popping sound in her knee, dropping her immediately to the ground. At first, they thought she was dogging it because the shot won the set, but she didn't get up. She couldn't. Even after it was discovered that the medial and arterial collateral ligaments were torn, modern medicine and a little sweat equity would bring her back. And it did. She would never get back to the baseline speed, which made her poison against opponents. And the so-called experts had no problem reminding her of that. Until the 2042 French Open, where she came in as an invite, unranked, and stole a country's heart. Reaching the women's final, where she had the number one ranked clay court performer and hometown favorite, Sylvie Bisquet, at her mercy, up 6-3, 6-4, and 5-2 before fate would once again deal her another killer blow. Same knee, same result. It forced a stunning withdrawal in one of the most devastating final matches ever in the sport. Growing up without a father and missing the touch of a caring partner, the likelihood of deep depression crept in. But the black angel that had walked in her hospital room changed all that as Chance, who was in London at the time of the beginning of the match, took the bullet tube to Paris, her press credential courtesy of his friend and colleague Anthony McLean from the sports agency BASN Newsroom. As he worked his way through the media scrum and patiently slipped out of each grouping until he could clearly see her, the only black face among a cacophony of what could only be called crappiest manifestos at the box office, or as the press box parasites would pick this apart in several languages. Finally alone, the older Beckford looked at Sarita, saying nothing, but holding on his arms as her almond-shaped eyes welled up. She buried her head in his chest and sobbed her heart out. From that moment, Sarita was adopted, and the sense of belonging guided her to rehab and the rest of her life. He gave her away when she married actor Jason Jefferson, and was in a divorce, as Jefferson couldn't handle even the smallest concept of a partner having more material success than he. Every time her knee turned, in quotes, as she would later describe it, Chance Beckford, like a doting father, was there to help heal it. It was soon after the divorce, Chance, through McLean, put in a call to a friend at Florida A&M and secured the tennis coach position for Sarita, who helped the school's Lady Rattlers tennis team reach the national finals 2 years straight, getting over the hump with the title in the second year. She finally looked for Beckford through the crowd. He smiled at her, and she said, "Now, it's my turn to cry." And they hugged. After a 5-year stint, budget cuts at the school eliminated golf, swimming, and tennis. But the point, career, and life had been made. Sarita could fill her eyes up. As they were welling up, she knew now it was her turn to cry. She was reminiscing. Jeanette Hatchett felt a shiver
go down her spine as the accounts of how chance had affected everyone's lives went on. She looked away from the ground as she felt another tremble rumble inside her. Couldn't have been indigestion. She hadn't eaten yet. It wasn't hunger pangs either. Imported Kansas, by any stretch of the imagination, was the jewel of industrial splendor. From the heartland, it had been reborn, nuclear energy, and a high-tech boom on a plateau with wheat fields and dust below. After Last Pro was formed, 8 states fought for the right to be the home base for the first of what would have been at least a dozen processing plants, not for food or electricity, but for elimination of chemical and nuclear waste. A considerable amount of politics and politrics elevated Kansas to a prominent position. And once Last Pro 1 was officially online, 27,000 well-paying permanent jobs followed, along with ancillary outlets for disposable income and an epic boost to the state's economy. Everyone that opposed Last Pro in Kansas, getting first dibs, screamed to whoever would listen as to how the Rust Belt or the Pacific Northwest would be better suited to accommodate. That noise was quelled when a press conference 15 months later announced Last Pros 2 and 3 were in the planning stages for Akron, Ohio, and Bellingham, Washington, respectively. Last Pro's waste initialization and synthesis process, or WISP, had been flawlessly tested for a year, meaning the federal government giving its blessing and a huge contract to Last Pro, as countless amounts of stored waste were being transported by rail and tracked and trailer into Emporia. Mimi and Malcolm Hatchett saw opportunity knocking. How you gonna turn down all that money, Nettie? It was ringing in her ears as her parents and Chance gently kicked her butt out of Hollis, Queens, and smack into the heartland. The article is entitled Plans Within Plans, written by Roscoe Beckford, courtesy of the Pure News, September 10th, 2008. As we approach the 7th anniversary of the September 11th attack, 2 reports released 5 years ago may provide kindling for another bonfire of protest before year's end. America's Environmental Protection Agency, in their assessment of air quality after the explosion of the Twin Towers, conceded the air around Ground Zero was safe before sufficient testing was completed. No one ever took EPA head Christine Todd Whitman to task for passing this lie onto the American public. And because of that, people are dying because of bureaucratic bullshit. So someone like former New York Giant player George Martin shouldn't have had to walk over 3,000 miles to make the point those affected by that disaster need expedited treatment to help them deal with what quality of life they have left. The ex-Giants defensive lineman reportedly lost 40 pounds in his 22-mile-a-day jaunt across our country. But the sports sentimentality focused more on Pac-Man Jones asking to be called by his natural name than pseudo-hip catchphrases rather than give attention to this. If they had just asked anyone living in Manhattan's Chinatown or Tribeca, the area known as the Triangle below Canal Street, 2 neighborhoods beyond the surrounding area about air quality, they would have told them a different story. Facial masks were standard issue over 4 months after September 11th. And in my dozen visits between then and now, I can personally concur to a distinct difference in the air from uptown to downtown at Ground Zero. The towers, essentially a mass of asbestos, glass, and steel, were vaporized in the incident, and the release of the asbestos and other toxins in the inferno has yet to be completed. just as elements like carbon-14, strontium-90, cesium-137, uranium-235, uranium-238, plutonium-239 break down after the explosion of nuclear devices via the half-life principle, so too does asbestos, albeit to a far lesser degree. In the quest to return to some sort of an immediate normalcy, the most abnormal thing was done to present such an occurrence from happening. And in my humble opinion, this was done at the behest of our government and the EPA. While any elementary science student worth his or her school books may know that, the government felt such information was beneath the public's notice. As if this wasn't bad enough, the second report may prove to be even more damning. The Port Authority of New York released transcripts of 911 calls from workers and personnel within both towers after the fateful first strike. Because of the inability to provide direction assistance to hundreds of frightened callers, many stood packed, unknowingly awaiting their deaths. Among them, employees and management on the landmark restaurant Windows on the World, which was located on the 107th floor of the One World Trade Center. One specific cry for help, however, evoked the most disturbing response. After the second tower was destroyed, an operator responded to a distress call by implying a third plane was also headed for New York City, and that, quote, the military had been informed and were taking action. Those very words may be the answer to a question some Canadians may have been asking themselves since that fateful day. I distinctly remember hearing over the Canadian news channel CBC, more than once I might add, five planes had struck targets in the U.S. Then sometime later, the news focused on four targets: the towers, the Pentagon, and the downed flight in Pennsylvania, with no further mention of a fifth target. Al Finley of Queens, New York, is one of many who lost their jobs due to the after effects of September 11th. And like many New Yorkers, feels he knows who is responsible. Quote, anyone who doesn't believe George Bush Jr. and his father are responsible for this happening must be out of their minds. Whatever agenda the Bushes had from the beginning, it's not working for anyone here 7 years later. They are putting more money into Iraq than they are in trying to restore or repair anything here. And meanwhile, two natural disasters and thousands more serving our country are coming home in body bags. Mr. Finley also confirmed that four planes hit targets and never at any time heard five planes striking the U.S. Days later at Yankee Stadium, and the emotional ceremony, which has now developed into a revised seventh inning ritual, we reaffirm our standing as seen God Bless America. Meanwhile, the Yankees, who have money and money's mama, want you to kick in another $400 million for their new stadium. Can someone tell me how the fuck we honor America by building another stadium that most folks can't afford to go to? And why isn't that taxpayer cash going to help those who were medically affected by 9/11? And what of the National Football League, who at one time got caught up in the pain of 9/11 and were supposedly to be considering the Super Bowl in the New York metropolitan area? I guess it had as much appeal as getting your cock sucked or a condom on to those that mattered, because the subject had as much shelf life as cum stains on a dark colored dress. As new media are erected across this nation, more and more of those implosions of old stadia are looking very similar to the Twin Towers crumbling before our eyes. What do you say to folks who think there's something funky going on when they can see it in front of their faces? Maybe George Martin's effort should have been focused on the gridiron greats that were pimped out by their own players union.
men who are damaged beyond time's healing factor because they cannot afford a quality of life befitting their contributions. In making a professional sports league, a generation of select young men, and in some cases, a handful of stupid, immature black motherfuckers, wealthy. This is by no means knocking Brother Martin. He did the right thing without hesitation, and we are proud of him. Science fiction author Frank Herbert, in his best-selling Dune series books, spoke of plans within plans as the standard operating procedure in taking action for and against the status quo. As we observe the last days in time, political blustering notwithstanding, most people could see through the bombast and were asking, why would the government want to keep such important information from the people that needed it most and at such a crucial time? Now, opinions are many. The roads to any possible answers seem to end at one particular destination: conspiracy. By definition, a conspiracy is a secret plan conceived by a group. Sadly, for many people living in North America and around the world, 2008 has become a year of reflection and reminder of days gone and last days of time. Like many others, I have been subjected to rewinding and replaying a burning knowledge of where I was and what I was doing when the unthinkable happened. My first thought of November 22nd, 1963 is my pops telling me about recess at public school 128. His class 4-1 is playing softball against class 4-6, and he's third up in the inning. They were down 4-2, and Harold Holloway leads off with a single. Billy Klotzbach, our big hitter, steps up the bat, and just as he's heading over and I'm walking into the on-deck circle, Miss McCafferty blows the whistle, telling everyone to bring in the equipment. Once back in our homeroom, the principal, a sadistic bastard named Mr. Frank, announces over the public address system that
President John Fitzgerald Kennedy has been assassinated.
The last word hanging in the air like the high pop fly Luis Torres hit to their second baseman, Rosa Marquez, in the previous inning. Almost 5 years later, Robert Kennedy, brother of John and a presidential hopeful, was murdered moments after winning a primary election in California. In both cases, a single gunman was charged with the crime. One conveniently killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the other incarcerated for life, Sirhan Sirhan. Just as in the movie JFK, I was about to sit down and eat something, and my sister Frances screamed at the television after seeing Kennedy's blood oozing out of his head. I remember her crying because she felt her boyfriend Lonnie, who would later become my brother-in-law, would be stuck in the jungles of Vietnam for even a longer time. While a probable conspiracy has been grudgingly admitted to 45 years or so later, the motives for killing both Kennedys was never made plausible until you understand the mindset behind those doing the deed. Everywhere else in the world, heads of state died at the hands of conspirators. Only in America did its leaders die because of a lone nut gunman. So did it. Well, probably the same group that felt that the money, talent, and connections Catholic outsider Joseph Kennedy had acquired, he looked to create his own American royalty in the 1960s, with his sons attaining the highest offices for a period lasting over a generation. Now, Barack Obama, with a similar vision, posture, and funds gathering apparatus, is looking to make similar inroads. Can anyone with any conscience not be thinking what may be running through the minds of some of us? I always wonder what it must be like to watch two oldest brothers being murdered, only to see it over and over again, while having the events being described to millions.
rather than wanting revenge, I guess if I were Edward Kennedy, I might have been co-opted into some sort of substance abuse myself. But what forces co-opt the inane drones who run professional and amateur sports? Until Miles Brand and the rest of the overseers running the NCAA plantation are overthrown, a lot of smiling faces will continue to pretend to be our friends on Saturdays in the fall. And those same faces will be laughing at those suffering pulmonary and renal failure, coughing and wheezing their last breaths, so fearful of fluid building up in their lungs, they know, unlike the rest of us, their next breath really could be their last. So, can you count, suckers? Ironically, the recent win by the Boston Celtics over the Los Angeles Lakers for the National Basketball Association Championship had me recalling one of the more intriguing movies of the 1970s, an action film entitled Three to Heartbreak, starring Kung Fu Master Jim Kelly and ex-football stars Fred the Hammer Williamson and Jim, the brother was so bad he didn't need the nickname Brown. The plot centered on poisoning the water supply in three American cities in a way where it only would affect black people. While we cheered in the theater as the bad guys were foiled, given the obligatory car chases and ass whippings supplied by our super bad brethren, the sad truth is that may have been at least 60 years too late. Unfortunately, the fears of many were realized as a groundbreaking novel, AIDS and Ebola, Emergence of Evil, written in 1997 by Dr. Lawrence Hockhauser, blows the doors off any suspicion AIDS was not some fluke of nature, but part of an agenda that sought to eliminate people of color off the face of the earth, or at very least, diminish their numbers to what the status quo would deem manageable. According to Dr. Hockhauser, the path to genocide did not start with Adolf Hitler. It started with the Rockefellers. As far back as the early 1900s, the Rockefeller family was driven to prove black people were genetically inferior to white ones. And their foundation for truth was a center for eugenics, where the practice of preaching proof of superiority began. From these beginnings, quotes Hockhauser, Hitler utilized these same beliefs in writing Mein Kampf, with Jews replacing black people in the twisted logic of evil. Sometime after World War II, the name of the Center for Eugenics was changed to the Genome Project. A clean sheet, the same hood, hiding the same intentions. Yeah, you could say, does this have to do with killing black folks? Everything from slavery to the Three-Fifths Compromise, where the U.S. declared and conceded that five black men were equal to three white men, how very white of them, to the infamous Tuskegee experiments with syphilis, to the AIDS pandemic, all were done to ignore a specific truth. There are far more people of color than those without, and those in control were very aware of this fact. Dr. Hockhauser knows this as well, and in my opinion, does humanity a huge favor by providing proof of the U.S. government's intent to create and disperse AIDS to the areas of greatest concentration. No Oliver Stone-flavored conspiracy stuff here, just names, dates, and most importantly, copies of contracts to people the United States government used to develop their biological warfare program. Most of that work done at the laboratories located in Fort Detrick, Maryland. Another of my all-time heroes, along with Dr. Hockhauser, is Joel A. Rogers, an historian, activist, and archivist who painstakingly sought to disprove the perception about black people in his works. Books like World's Great Men of Color, Amazing Facts About the Negro with Complete Proof, and The Five Negro Presidents. While Rogers' proof was factual regarding the collective culture, Hockhauser's proof is factual regarding our survival. There are three distinct differences between myself and everyone else on this ball of dirt we call the earth: the texture and color of one's hair, my youngest daughter, Nia, would say, or lack of, eye color, and the amount of melanin in one's skin. That's it. However, this reality doesn't sit well with a status quo operating on a 24/7, 365 basis to stay in control. It may take a nation of millions to hold us back, but an effort of billions is needed to counter these distractions, these plans within plans, and recognize our future can eventually fall back in our own hands again if you can count. No one said a word about how not one twist of blew its way across the plains that fall. Well, global warming was accepted as plausible, but as a reason, it generated nothing more than a mere mumble of conversation between bites of barbecue to those born and raised there. To be sure, the real response was mostly relief, and that it was their turn catch a break in the constantly revamping world of weather. And then, as if on cue, Mother Nature would lay a multi-billion dollar bitch slap on the world by letting Kansas know there's no place like home unless there's no home at all. The clearing sky the evening of December 2nd, 2045 gave no indications as to what would commence the following day. A 35-degree shock drop in temperature meant nothing more than another cold day and a good day to be able to stay at home until the power went out. The generators in Brownlee Medical Center kicked in and worked without incident. The generators at City Hall functioned with no problems, as did the radio and TV stations. But LasPros shuddered and sputtered intermittently for approximately 4 minutes before performing as expected. It would later be revealed that in those 4 minutes, WISP reactors failed to react, after a momentary freakout by tech support, all indicators showed green for continued operations at maximum capacity. The climate and control environment never had a chance, as the mix of new technology and old building codes had now created the workplace more noxious than the waste. The WISP reactors and their high-intensity lasers were designed to accelerate the half-life of radioactive byproducts until complete dissipation. WISP would make LASPRO a Fortune 500 company, and its creator, Joe Augusto, later to change his name to Joel Augustine, already a multimillionaire, was armed with influence which would make him worth billions. The bustling work floor was in the middle of a shift change. Chatter about activity logs and program runs deviated into how the Jayhawks were doing and whether Kansas City would get that second shot at a National Hockey League franchise now that the league was stable again. Nettie Hatch knew the power was still out and debated whether to stick around until knowing a little more. But the desire to sleep in her own bed trumped any thought of lingering over a cup of coffee longer than needed in the cafeteria. "What's on the take home, Nettie?" Brother, a husky young man named Ronnie. Ronnie's stocky body, muscular build, and tenacious approach as a linebacker in high school led to his rather appropriate nickname of Bear. "Let me turn on an omelet for you." Hatchet's insides growling sparked the answer. "Sounds good, Bear. Ham, cheddar, and mushroom, please." A nagging feeling continued to come over Nettie as she engaged in small talk with Bear about his rehab for his knee. Minutes later, Bear handed Nettie a bag. "There you go, baby, with extra home fries for my homegirl." Nettie smiled and thanked Ronnie. "I just might see you later, Nettie. Until full power's restored, I'm going to have to grind through a double shift." Hatchet left and took the 15-minute drive down Interstate 35 to her apartment. The radio account implied things were getting colder but better as power was being restored to most of Chase County and all of Linn County. Coming into her apartment complex, the buzz of her Quattro phone rattled in her purse. Nettie answered after dropping her breakfast on the dinette table. "Hello, Nettie. It's Ron." His voice sounding weak. "What's wrong, Bear?" "Something's not right, Jeanette. I was calling you to tell you not to eat your breakfast because I thought the food was bad. But I know the food is good because I cooked it. People here just started throwing up in the cafeteria. Then a couple of folks just passed out." Nettie noticed the nightlight coming on and grabbed the remote he clicked on the TV as Bear continued wheezing. "I don't know what it is, but I'm getting out of here. I see a lot of others acting up. Nettie, I'm out. I hope I see you later. But don't come back here." Nettie at the news station, as more information about power restored came in, the TV cut away to a breaking news story. "This is Ingrid Montfort, about a mile and a half away, outside of Emporia and the LASPRO Processing Center. Apparently, several 911 calls were made from inside LASPRO with the bulk of them referring to a gas leak, which is at last report being attended to, according to a LASPRO official. There has been a roadblock posted here near the entrance to U.S. Highway 50, and traffic is being rerouted. We will provide you with updates as this story develops." The developing story would lead to dubious statements by LASPRO upper management and several legal actions, which would eventually lead to the class action suits Atkins, Hutchinson et al. V. LASPRO and Augustine v. Kansas, leading to a few million spread out over 2,500 employees directly affected by the Emporia incident. For a man like Augustine, it was merely the price of doing business. The next time the phone rang, it was Mama Mimi. "Baby, get your ass back here now." Nettie Hatcher then remembered another funeral, one that took place roughly 3 months later, when Ronald Bear Henderson died mercifully in his sleep. a victim of aggravated lymphoma, which was ostensibly linked to acute radiation poisoning. In spite of a formal inquiry declaring that Lazpro and Augustine were not held liable for what happened in Emporia, the Akron and Bellingham plans were scrapped, leaving two corporate wastelands and over 50,000 potential jobs in their wake. The other 9,000 people who would eventually die over the next 3 years to related forms of lymphoma or other cancer-related deaths were obvious enough for a study to be justifiable. The spike was attributed to Augustine, Lazpro, and everything which happened that fateful date in Emporia. But the fact there was no attempt to approach the government with any proposal toward prosecuting beyond the initial culpability led to the depressing conclusion of money talk. In spite of several government subsidies, anything within a 10-mile radius of the Lazpro site couldn't be given away until call centers established in the Jeb Bush administration were built on the same land. Emporia eventually became a Section 8 haven, and the trade-off of what appeared to be a better quality of life for a significantly shorter lifespan. Nia and Nicole took in all the verbal accounts and assessed the total input. Satisfied the ground around the blast had sufficiently cooled, Nia motioned to Nicole to take out the plaque designed for the space. I can remember when people had the choice to cremate, bury, or whatever. Because of body snatchers reclaiming bone marrow to be used in gin executions, our father insisted on cremation. Nicole took out an urn and poured the ashes into the hole. Nia then blasted the full steel plaque so that it covered over the hole. Nicole once again whipped out her laser pistol and blasted around the border of the plaque until plaque and earth fused with each other. Kwame Gray, a burnished brown, solidly built young man about 6 feet tall, took a bottle out of his jacket. With all due respect, some things never change and they're not supposed to. He flipped the label around for everyone to see. Mad Dog 666. A wine so nasty, even winos refused it. Kwame took a swig and passed it to everyone in the circle. Damn, I know this stuff had people barking at the moon back in the day. With some sipping faster than others, Nicole took the last sip before spilling the rest at the gravesite. She then coughed and paused to pop a mint in her mouth as everyone prepared to leave. Before we leave here, I think we have to come to grips with one thing. We know this clone meat thing tied into a lot of dangerous stuff. And I think Kwame can vouch for the fact that we won't get a straight answer from the government, given the changes to the Freedom of Information Act in 2009. We've been blessed and cursed with parents that were close, that loved us, that had us bear a very huge burden. From long before we were born, genetic experiments were done on black folks, guinea pigs for extended exposure to syphilis, gene isolation for sickle cell, the AIDS virus, and so on. And our relatives discovered the path this country was taking with thinning out the herd through genetic engineering. We knew something was not right. Clone meat was questionable to begin with, but now for every black person, it is a true health hazard. It's not fair to ask you all to drop your lives and go on this path my sister and I are planning to undertake. But we were all taught evil prospers when good men and women do nothing. So, sighed Nicole, what are we going to do about this? Chapter 2, Gen Executions. How the fuck could they get away with this? This is elementary school science stuff. Kwame Gray, TPN staff writer. March 4th, 2017. It was a little after 5 p.m. and Chance Bradford was home, between sips of blueberry tea, before the air was punctuated by squeals of delight. Oh, damn! Half Chance's friend Mason Child. He really fucked that boy up. Look at the hook he drops on Biggs. Run that shit back. The VHS tape. Word back to the spot on the tape just before Mike Tyson levels Tyrone Biggs with a murderous shot that drops the bloody Biggs to the canvas. To which Childs, a middle-aged spread full of humor and one of the few black sports columnists in the country, responds with gusto. Ow! Man, that's when Tyson was Tyson. It's a damn shame how his life turned out, man. Yeah, Mace, brother man was a beast. He had won that fight from the opening bell, though. How do you see that? I mean, Biggs was a contender. And he didn't seem like he was afraid of Tyson. True. But I distinctly remember how Biggs kind of teased Tyson when they were in the amateur ranks. And he sought to distance himself away from Tyson because the indication that Tyson was some unpolished Neanderthal. Tyson took all that rage and punished Biggs for the perception of being dogged out of nothing else. After that first good shot, he could have dropped his ass anytime he wanted in the first round. He carried Biggs' ass a few rounds more for the specific purpose of letting Biggs know he fucked with the wrong cat. And we never heard from Tyrone Biggs ever again after that bout. Mike Tyson never had more respect in my eyes than after that fight, his signature moment. Childs drained the beer he had been nursing for the last few moments, taking in Chance's words as he clunked the can on the coffee table. He was an affable middle-aged man, similar in dimensions to Tyson, not nearly as muscular. Childs reached up for another beer out the mini-fridge, popping the top and taking a healthy sip. You know what bothers the fuck out of me? We've got like a half a dozen heavyweight champions right now. It's a disgrace to the sport. They perpetuate this. They perpetrate this madness. There should be only one undisputed champ for every weight class in boxing. But we'll probably never see that again. There's just too much cash involved in diluting the product. If black folks didn't buy these pay-per-view fights and protest to all these alphabet titles, we could force them to unify the titles. I've been thinking about writing a column to that effect, my Charles. I'll go you one better, boss Chance. Hit the rewind button on the remote to an earlier part of the fight. As the action resumed, Tyson, the smaller, shorter fighter, was aggressively stalking the taller, stunned Biggs before exploding a right hand into Biggs' breadbasket. Whereupon, Chance hit the pause button. If black folks had responded to Katrina like Tyson did to Biggs, we wouldn't be lost in body counts right now. It has been over a decade since Hurricane Katrina descended on the Gulf Coast portion of the United States in 2005, leveling everything from Biloxi, Mississippi to New Orleans and all points in between. A city with much of it below sea level, New Orleans was bordered by levees on one side, Lake Pontchartrain on the other side, and the Gulf of Mexico. The destruction of the levees poured countless gallons of water into the city's basin, killing the power and immobilizing the 22 pumps that forced out sewage and industrial waste on a daily basis. The inaction of the part of the federal, state, and local governments didn't help the process any either. As the early days following Katrina were devoted to more coverage of black people looting as opposed to whites finding stuff, the ecological nightmare was brewing. Waste materials, fecal matter, uprooted corpses, decaying human and animal carcasses, and spoiled food continued to fester. Carbon monoxide emanating from gas leaks, along with mosquitoes and biting flies, buzzed above, carrying the threats of West Nile virus, malaria, cholera, and dysentery, while poisonous snakes and alligators lurked below. With a good portion of New Orleans bubbling on the 20 feet of this noxious stew, before the pumps were again functional, thousands were relocated, and Hurricane Katrina became a symbol of the country's lack of preparedness for such situations and their utter disregard for American citizens of color. and President George W. Bush in his State of the Union address in 2006 touched on several issues that evening, but devoted less than a minute to acknowledge the aftermath and progress in the Gulf Coast from Katrina. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, their design was to prepare the nation for all disasters, national and natural, as well as managing federal response and recovery efforts. But getting things back to the way they were was never the intent. A significant section of the city, a predominantly black Ninth Ward, was eventually dredged and redeveloped into recreational acreage and high-end condominiums in a revamped New Orleans that was now half the population prior to Katrina. In the dredging, body parts of unearthed corpses lit the fuse for another TPN headline dated March 14, 2008. Is New Orleans cursed ground? Commentary by Roscoe Beckford. I am pleased to report the 17th Street levee that was designed to protect the 9th Ward from Mother Nature and Lake Pontchartrain has finally been prepared, rather should say repaired. Through a joint engineering agreement with the Netherlands, the levee has been rebuilt and fortified to such an extent that spokespeople for the Army Corps of Engineers, in a prepared statement, opined the new levee could withstand a Category 5 hurricane. Now all we have to do is identify every one of the over 11,000 body parts that were dredged, and maybe a lot of souls will finally be able to truly rest in peace. Provided, of course, we can find out what happened to the storage area in Jefferson Parish, which was vandalized on St. Valentine's Day earlier this year, where each and every part cataloged in the facility has now disappeared. Little, if any, action has been taken by the local police or state or federal government to address this issue, as there has been no coverage indicating anything is being done to appease the thousands of family members still in limbo across other parts of the country who still cannot find closure to the tending of their loved ones. Ironically, it wasn't until September 11th of 2011 that some of those body parts turned up. The controlled mainstream media would put that man and that notion to sleep for at least two generations, even in spite of the seventh black president. The column, "The Day Barack Stood Still," written by the Pure News by Roscoe Beckford. The article starts with a letter. King, King, look into your heart. We know you're a complete fraud and a great liability to all us Negroes. White people in this country have enough frauds of their own, but I am sure they don't have anyone at this time that is your equal. You are no clergyman, and you know it. I repeat, you're a colossal fraud and an evil, vicious one at that. King, like all frauds, your end is approaching. You should have been our greatest leader, but you are done. Your honorary degrees, your Nobel Prize, what a grim farce, and other awards will not save you, King. I repeat, you are done. The American public, the church organizations that have been helping, Protestants, Catholics, and Jews, will know you for what you are, an evil, abnormal beast. So will others who have backed you. You are done. King, there is only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. You have just 34 days left to do. This exact number has been selected for a specific reason. It has definite, practical significance. You are done. This is an excerpt from the 1964 letter, which was sent to Dr. Martin Luther King before he could accept the Nobel Peace Prize. This was part of several thousand documents which were declassified and edited in blackout fashion as part of the Federal Bureau's investigation of counterintelligence program, also known as COINTELPRO. Dateline, New York City, TPN, it has now come down to the final days. And sometime late in the evening on November 4th, Barack Obama will be able to sit while the rest of the planet stands still. Just as the space traveler Klaatu nailed his craft in Washington, D.C. in the science fiction epic, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Barack Hussein Obama. Be proud of your name, my brother. His trip seems to be a sum, like he jumped off the mothership of a similar ilk. Called everything by everybody, Obama has been human and humane while dealing with many who would treat him as if he were not on this earth. Death threats, cries of terrorists, and schemes designed to objectify him into a target suitable for termination because of the power structures, organization, and realization could well be the sum of their fears. An intelligent, capable black man ready to destroy every fabric of stereotypical dysfunction and lead the most powerful nation on earth like none before him, because there were six before him that they knew about, is now in plain sight in the eyes of the world. In 1960, a similar scenario existed with John Kennedy's run to the presidency. Catholics, women, and of course black people, like everyone who from society's take at the time was on the outside looking in, they now became infused with hope that things were really going to get better. Now, nearly 50 years later, sons and daughters of those on the left, right, and center of the policies endured under the current administration have collectively shown so much positive light on this brother. They can only hope for the best. Even those experiencing the full brunt of joblessness, war, lack of education, and an economy which has siphoned so much green from black, yellow, white, red, and brown hands, that gray is the color of their present, can carry on with a purpose, hoping that a change is going to come. And in the real world, how will that change manifest itself with the fear of another black president? Will the winning teams of the major sports leagues be as passionate in coming to the Black House for the handshake ceremony and photo op? Will the efforts to host a World Cup or Olympic Games in the United States be compromised because the world sporting community propels the bids due to the fact that it would provide a successful platform for the new president's endeavor in getting Americans working? Will ownership in sports leagues be encouraged by an admitted basketball fan like Barack Obama? Could it lead to a new NBA franchise in Seattle with potential minority owners? Will Brat C League be enthused in having President Obama throw out the first ball on opening day for the Washington Nationals, or for that matter, Chicago's Cubs and White Sox? Will the admitted right-wing leanings of many of the NFL owners give them pause in their interaction with a black man as the nation's leader? Will our Winter Olympic team go to Vancouver in 2010 and meet on the Black House lawn? Will some punk kid who was jealous of his black teammate in the previous Olympics cause a scene because he doesn't like the color of the new president? When a caller comes from the Black House to a World Series MVP, will the party accept the call or leave our nation's leader on hold? Will the NCAA shake in its shiny shoes as the President Obama announces sweeping reforms in collegiate athletics and advocates student-athletes getting paid? Will Hank Williams Jr. lose his Monday night singing gig to George Clinton because of the way he dogged out Obama? Indeed. Could this Chocolate City candidate have enough flavor to sweeten life for all its citizens and not just those green with more than envy in the outlying vanilla suburbs? Will he look into the mistreatment of American citizens, many of them black and brown and poor, after being called refugees in their own homeland after the Katrina tragedy, but many still not properly compensated or relocated from their homes? will the truth be revealed that Barack Obama is actually the seventh black president and not the first? Texas school board producers, please take note. Can he show compassion for all as a humanist, or will he be revealed as an elitist who intends to do nothing but mollify the masses while maintaining the status quo? Just as there is nothing harder to stop than an idea whose time has come to pass, there are those who will not stoop to any level of indecency to maintain the status quo. The many generations of those who kicked a million asses to get it and a billion more to keep it, those and their apostates will stop at nothing to warn about the threat to their way of life. Like plot two in the movie, others were warned about what to do should a monster like Obama be released into an unsuspecting populace. Radio talking heads and media columnists are now chanting the phrase designed to stop the alien black menace. Fuck you, toxic Negro. But unbeknownst to the mobs, Obama has already unleashed his weapon, a giant of earth and steel, forged in areas like the Black Hills of Montana and black neighborhoods in every major urban center. From white plains to the white majority farm states like Iowa, from Georgia's red clay to red states previously immune to Democratic influence, the hulking sentinel standing by Obama's name is vote, and through its piercing eye hums the pulse of an entire nation. So when each time the phrase is uttered, every time, fuck you, toxic Negro, is screamed over the airways or written to inflame editorially or cooed between winks of assured intent, the masses will do the right thing. The order is given. Vote. Quote, I am leaving soon, and you will forgive me if I speak bluntly. The universe grows smaller every day, and the threat of aggression by any group, anywhere, can no longer be tolerated. There must be security for all, or no one is secure. Now, this does not mean giving up any freedom, except the freedom to act irresponsibly. Your ancestors knew this when they made the laws to govern themselves and hired policemen to enforce them. Now, we of the other planets have long accepted this principle. We have an organization for the mutual protection of all planets and for the complete elimination of aggression. The test of any such higher authority is, of course, the police force. The police force that supports it. For our policemen, we created a race of robots. Their function is to patrol the planets and spaceships like this one and preserve the peace. In matters of aggression, we have given them absolute power over us. This power cannot be revoked. At the first sign of violence, they act automatically against the aggressor. The penalty for provoking an action is too terrible to risk. The result is that we live in peace with our arms or army, secure in the knowledge that we are free from aggression and war, free to pursue more profitable enterprises. Now, we do not pretend to have achieved perfection, but we do have a system, and it works. I came here to give you these facts. It is no concern of ours how you run your own country, but if you threaten to extend your violence, this earth of yours will be reduced to a burnt-out cinder. Your choice is simple. Join us and live in peace. Will pursue your present course and face obliteration. We shall be waiting for your answer. The decision rests with you. Will the angry masses stop this Leviathan with the power of its command phrase, or will vote bring order and peace to the universe? With apologies to Robert Wise. March 4th, 2057. Kwame Gray's locks peeled and peeked over his computer screen as he attempted to play catch-up with the morning news. Three more deaths wouldn't have garnered any more attention anywhere else any other day until Gray read the caption in TPN's obituary file. Errol McWilliams, born August 18th, 1990, died March 2nd, 2057. Scrolling down, Ray found another posting. Marlon McWilliams, born June 16, 2014, died March 2, 2057. Immediately after, a third listing, Carolyn McWilliams Cook, born December 12, 2016, died March 2, 2057. Gray got up from his desk and strolled across the room to the cubicle belonging to his colleague, features reporter Cheryl Childs. "Hey, Cher," smiled Kwame. "Molly Gorgeous, I need you to take a peek at this. Log on to TrinaFX.com. Childs looked up over her eyeglasses. "To yourself, what's up?" "Do you remember a Caroline McWilliams Cook?" asked Gray. "I don't remember the cook part," said Childs, "but I do remember the Caroline McWilliams that sang in Pride of Lions before Fitzroy Skinner broke the group up. How come?" "She just died, along with a couple more people with the same surname." Childs' eyes widened as she logged onto the site Gray suggested, one of several New Orleans-based sites that chronicled the legacy of Katrina. Hey, looks like we got a match. Caroline McWilliams Cook, born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, passed away from what was diagnosed as complications from sickle cell anemia. Gray bit his lower lip as he saw the information pop up on screen. "Hold that thought," he said, running back to his cubicle. "Cheryl, type in Errol McWilliams and see what you get." "I don't have to," said Cheryl. "He just came up. I got him on screen. Yes, he is Caroline's daddy. Born in New Orleans, fourth out of six kids. Three older brothers, two sisters, died of heart failure March 2nd, 2057 at age 77 in Fresno, California. And a Marion McWilliams who died the same day in Oakland," says Charles. "Don't you mean Marlon McWilliams? I got a guy listed here who died the same day living in Houston," shouted Greg. "Well, you just got some company because I did find Marlon and a Marion McWilliams, both born June 16, 2014. Whoa. Check this out, Kwame. The twins apparently died due to complications from sickle cell." Greg hit the update icon on his site and the new TPN configuration just above the particulars for Marlon McWilliams came the details of his deceased sister. Damn. Gray picked up the phone only to hang it up again after hearing the busy signal kick in after the dial tone. He then reached into his pocket and took out his cell phone. "They can still trace this if they want to, but if I don't call him, it's maybe the only time I'll have a chance to reach him. Still, odds of four family members dying in different locations on the same day would justify any griping you'd get from Gator." Moments later, a phone rang in a small house in Port Jervis, New York. Walter Gator Green kept the ringer off in the bedroom to better ignore its existence. He could justify not picking up because anyone who knew him knew better to not call the house until after 12:30 p.m. But the rattling sound in the drawer of his captain's bed couldn't be ignored. As Green reached for his horn-rimmed glasses and cell phone, the sound buzzing made him think of an angry bumblebee channeling Richard Pryor. "This is Officer Green." "Well, that's real good, because this is Kwame Gray from the Pure News. What the fuck are you calling me to tell us something in the morning, man? You know I got to get my sleep." "Look, bro, we need to link up. I got some bona fide shit on something we spoke on a while back. I just need you to do some detective work." "What is it right now, Kwame? You chasing laser polluters again?" No. This is way bigger. "Remember the stuff your Uncle Les was talking about the last time you all got together? About the ability to kill through the use of talismans?" Yeah. "So that Twilight Zone shit don't mean anything in the light of day." And Green turns over, half-assed interested in what Gray has to say. "The archives just turned up four people from the same family who died on the same day." "Again, so what? Auto accident, fire. In four different parts of the country, Gator." Gray knew from the silence Gator was sitting up and putting on his glasses. "Got your attention now, huh? Now, before you say anything else, I don't think this is voodoo or a hit, but I have been taking notes of familial coincidences like this for over a year now.
Well, it could have been a hit.
What were they into? I don't know about they, but from all accounts, they were just regular working class folks. One used to sing with a reggae band.
But there you go. Might have been some shiesty shit going down.
Yo, Babylon, man. This is the first time so many people were affected like this at the same time, and I don't need to have an actuary done to determine the odds of four family members dying on the same day in different cities being fucking astronomical. Dean was fully awake now. All right, I'm with you. What do you need? I need you to speak to anyone in Louisiana who might have indirect access to those Orleans Parish records back in the day. Freedom of information inquiries are too damn long, and even after they respond favorably, most of it's redacted when they send it. We don't have that kind of time, Greg. Gator sent in his friend's anger piped up. Wait a minute, aren't you press people supposed to be objective? There's no sense in getting pissed off about shit that happened 50 years ago. My brother. They took a deep breath. I'm not mad at you. It's the situation. How the fuck could they get away with this? This is elementary science school stuff. It just assumes black people are incapable of deductive reasoning and deciphering information. It's insulting. And I'll have to allow myself to get the anger out so I can be calm and focused again. I feel you, Quan. And I think you should be keeping in mind that if we do find anything of value here, it will be because of exactly what you said. My man, they will not see us coming. Now, can I please get the fuck back to sleep? Continue with part three at another time. But for now, please, wherever you are, go safe, stay safe, be safe. If you're traveling, know we want you to get from point A to B and back to A-OK. All of us here at the tree, tuck in, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite. Good night.